You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Saul Gonzalez of KQED's The California Report, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. Southern California consistently ranks as having some of the worst road conditions in the country. A recent report by the nonprofit Transportation Research Institute TRIP found that 57% of roads in the Los Angeles, Long Beach, Anaheim region are rated in poor condition. That's just one reason why Southern Californians are keeping an eye on President Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure spending plan that could bring a flood of money, construction projects, and jobs to the region. Here's how the president made the case last week in Cleveland.
A quarter of all the miles Americans travel on roads are an interstate highway system built 60 years ago, 60 years after we built it. These are generational investments. Private sector does not make these kind of investments.
Now, Republicans have countered with their own infrastructure plan, just shy of $1 trillion. But regardless of the final dollar amount and the politicking all around it, Californians will reap the biggest piece of this spending pie. And that's got folks across Greater LA jostling for position. Which projects deserve priority? And who decides all of this? KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covers the business of Southern California and joins me now to discuss. Hey, Ben.
Hey there, Saul. Good to talk to you.
Great. Well, set the table. First off, what is in the president's infrastructure bill?
Well, this is a massive spending bill, and one of the biggest investments is $100 billion plus to modernize things like bridges, highways, and roads that are in the worst shape. You mentioned some of those here in Los Angeles. There's some other things too, close to $175 billion for electric vehicles, for charging stations. You've got tens of millions more for things like airport terminal upgrades, train systems, removing lead pipes from cities, retrofitting buildings, high-speed internet. Saul, it is a really lengthy list.
Well, you know, Ben, obviously our roads and highways and freeways need help, but we also have other issues, right? Like internet access problems, airports that certainly need updating too. What might be happening there in terms of Southern California?
Well, in terms of Southern California, there's a lot on the line here, right? Some examples of projects that are in the works: electrifying the Burbank to Anaheim passenger rail system. That's something officials really want. Also, straightening the Amtrak line from LA to San Diego to cut travel time. If you've ever taken that train, it can take hours, and sometimes it's baffling as to why, right?
Yes to all of the above.
San Bernardino County wants to extend the Metrolink line by 9 miles into Redlands. You've got even more upgrades at LAX on the table. And that is just the start of it, says Matt Peterson. He's the CEO of Lacey, which is this green tech incubator here in LA, and he was also the first sustainability officer under Mayor Eric Garcetti. And he says he's excited for money that will electrify trucks that haul goods from the ports of LA and Long Beach to warehouses in the Inland Empire. Those trucks, by the way, are a major source of pollution here, and by electrifying them, it would significantly reduce the pollution that spews into the communities that are along the freeways, like the 710, the 110, the 5, and the 60.
Those emission reductions aren't just about fighting the climate crisis. They're about reducing the disproportionate burden put upon frontline communities along the 710, along the I-5, wherever they are, where these trucks, diesel trucks that move 40% of all the goods that come into the United States from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach out to the warehouses in the Inland Empire or beyond, those frontline communities suffer the most from that air pollution.
And along with improving the environment through higher quality infrastructure, I think of job creation, right? I mean, that's why a lot of politicians love to talk about infrastructure. What's at stake there for Southern California?
Well, it's certainly why politicians like to talk about it, and it's why they're talking about this bill, Saul. It's something that Democratic Congressman Jimmy Gomez says his district desperately needs after 15 months of the pandemic. I mean, he represents parts of East, downtown, and Northeast LA, and I caught up with him recently at the construction site of the new 6th Street Bridge, which connects Boyle Heights with downtown LA. This is a massive, almost $600 million project. It's decades in the making. And Gomez says these are the types of projects that this federal money would fund. And he says that's a big reason why his community supports these types of infrastructure investments. Gomez says this project will put local people to work and others too. And Biden's infrastructure bill is thinking about jobs, which is something important to him.
This is actually money that's being kept in the community, that's being spent in the community, and it's multiplying those dollars in the community. So it's providing jobs. But now that we're doing this American, this national infrastructure plan, we're going to have a large component of Buy American, like where the products are coming from, but also local hire provisions.
And Saul, in the case of the 6th Street Bridge, Gomez says hundreds of local workers were hired to build that. So it's an example of things that possibly could come.
So let's just assume there's just a bunch of dollars coming Southern California and LA's way when it comes to infrastructure. Who decides how to spend it? Who says, yeah, it goes to that subway project, or no, it doesn't, it goes to that highway project or that EV charging station installation? Who does that?
Gosh, Saul, I wish it was an easy answer, but the actual truth is that there are a lot of stakeholders who decide. Of course, the governor plays an enormous role, but you've also got the state legislature, and then there are city mayors or county supervisors. And also those who sit on these boards all across California and Los Angeles. I'm talking water boards, air quality boards, transportation boards like Metro. It's really a patchwork of decision making that can pit different projects against each other. Needless to say, there's going to be a lot of lobbying in the coming days and weeks to come over where this money will go. And people who live in neighborhoods where there will be potentially big projects are really concerned that something could go wrong, and they want a seat at the table in the coming months.
Well, that certainly makes sense, right? Because a lot of the dirtiest infrastructure projects often go to some of the poorest places in Southern California, working class Black and Latino neighborhoods. Is that a concern?
You know, it's a perennial concern. And I spoke with somebody who knows all about it. His name is Mark Lopez. He's a community organizer with the nonprofit East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice. We met in a parking lot at the confluence of the 60 and 710 freeways. And there's a Gold Line stop there as well. It's unincorporated East LA County. And when these freeways were built, they displaced people and subjected the communities nearby to decades of pollution. Saul, when we met out there, it was really hard to draw breath while we sat outside.
So yeah, the air is heavy out here. And I think, you know, one of the primary things that we have to do in our community organizing is help our fellow residents understand that this isn't normal.
Not normal, Saul, as in not every community in Los Angeles has to even deal with this. Now, Lopez calls the placement of the freeways environmental racism that was, in his mind, done intentionally and can be undone.
None of it exists naturally. That freeway was planned, that freeway was planned, the other freeway, you know? The Gold Line, the rail yards, these warehouses, right? All of that is planned. And what that means is that we can change the plans.
Now, Saul, I should point out President Biden is aware of these dynamics, and Democrats are hoping to address them in this bill. There's actually $20 billion in redress to communities whose neighborhoods, typically non-whites, were divided by highway projects. So there is attention to this issue.
All right. That is KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb talking infrastructure. Ben, thanks so much.
Saul, anytime.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Saul Gonzalez sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. Is the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department ripping off the residents of Compton by not providing the levels of protection the department promised the city in a $22 million contract? That's what the city of Compton is arguing in a new legal claim. The city alleges that the LASD routinely bills the city for patrols that just don't happen. Sheriff Alex Villanueva at a news conference last week said, quote, "We measure the minutes, we have to get close to the 100%, either slightly above or slightly below. The department says that it's conducting its own investigation into the allegations with one of their biggest clients. Here to discuss the Compton controversy is Max Huntsman, Inspector General for Los Angeles County, where he serves as an independent watchdog of the LA County Sheriff's Department. Inspector General, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So explain some of the specifics of Compton's complaint and this issue of apparently ghost cars. What is that all about?
Ghost cars is an accounting trick used in law enforcement, the sheriff's department in particular, in which cars are written down as patrolling an area when, in fact, the people in them aren't patrolling that area. They're doing desk duties or some other kind of work that isn't appropriately counted.
And that's what Compton is alleging, that the city has been full of these phantom cars that haven't really been out on the streets patrolling?
That work that is being done for one purpose that is not reimbursable by Compton is being billed to them as reimbursable for Compton, the equivalent of ghost cars. I have not been able to look into the allegations because the sheriff's department has obstructed our investigation, so I can't tell you the details.
Sure. How did these allegations come to light?
In this particular instance, a whistleblower made the claims, and the lawsuit is built off of some of the allegations of the whistleblower. But allegations of ghost cars have been around for years.
Sheriff Villanueva says this is basically a dispute over counting hours, tabulating hours, and it's been blown way out of proportion. As IG, what's your response to that?
My response is then he should open his books. The state law requires checks and balances. It requires that politicians who are trusted with public money allow appropriate agencies to investigate. And 10 years ago, the sheriff's department had a horrible scandal in which they fought against external investigation, and the sheriff went to prison as a result. History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Beyond Compton, how common are these agreements between the sheriff's department and cities in Los Angeles County that allow for the sheriff's department to provide law enforcement protection to cities?
Very common. By the state constitution, the sheriff patrols unincorporated areas, but for cities, there has to be a contract for the sheriff to do that, and a large number of the 88 cities in the county of Los Angeles do contract with the sheriff's department for law enforcement.
And why would cities want to do that? Why not just have their own cops, their own police?
It's expensive to run a police department. There's overhead. You have to have a whole bunch of policies. You create liability when there are allegations of misconduct. There's a lot of reasons. Then there can also be reasons that are specific to a jurisdiction. Compton used to have its own police department, and they changed to the sheriff's department because they were unhappy with the results they were getting.
Hmm. And how are the contracts negotiated? I assume they vary from one community to another, but does a city approach the sheriff and say, hey, we want you to provide X amount of patrols at Y cost? Let's start negotiating it. Is that basically how it works?
That's basically correct. And they tend to be very formulaic in terms of the number of hours and number of patrol cars, number of assigned deputies and what they do.
And are these contracts a pretty significant revenue source for LASD?
They are. They are because they're an additional revenue source. Politicians are always looking for extra money, and there's the money that is covered by the budget and that you can count on, and then there are additional sources. So when the Sheriff's Department, for instance, lost the Metro contract not that many years ago, that was a huge blow. It's always a concern within any large bureaucracy to maintain cash flow.
To the degree you can say, do these agreements tend to be good for cities? I mean, you know, is the law enforcement presence there in the numbers that the cities expected? Are the patrols happening? Do the cities feel that they're getting their money's worth?
You don't know, and I don't know, because the sheriff has chosen to block external investigation. I can't answer that question. And the fact that I can't should trouble you.
Yeah, you're the inspector general. Well, you should be able to answer that question. It's a pretty rudimentary one, no?
Not just should, but the law says I must be able to, and yet the sheriff has refused to allow it.
And is that like the corporate culture of the sheriff's department, or is that Villanueva specifically?
A little of both. I think the sheriff's department has always been difficult to penetrate and secretive at times, and that's why we had a previous sheriff who went to prison. But Villanueva in particular has taken an aggressive political stance against oversight and has me under criminal investigation. So, you know, it's certainly something he's doing in spades compared to other sheriffs.
So when it comes to Compton specifically, again, Compton has filed this legal claim with the county. What comes next in the coming weeks and months?
County Council controls litigation, so the county, not the Sheriff's Department, should be looking into the facts. We should not be obstructed on our ability to collect information so that we can work with County Council so they can find out if any of the allegations are true or not. And if the sheriff continues to obstruct that, the end result will be more litigation and more exposure of the public's money to be paid to the city of Compton.
You've been on KCRW in the past, and you've complained about the LASD's lack of transparency. You did it in this very conversation a couple of minutes ago. The LA County Board of Supervisors has threatened and pressured the sheriff to open up to have greater transparency. Have you seen, and you choose your period of time, the last 3 months, 6 months, last year, have you seen any improvement at all when it comes to transparency issues or just cooperating with civilian partners in LA County?
Since I get to choose my time period, I'll choose 3 months, which is when the state AG's office began an investigation into civil rights abuses in the Sheriff's Department, alleged. And since that time, you would expect the Sheriff's Department to be more cooperative, but in fact, they've become less so and ramped up their political threats and investigations and intimidations. So I think it's getting worse, not better.
You know, my words, not yours, but it sounds like you're describing like a rogue agency.
Absolutely.
So if that's your opinion, Mr. Huntsman, do you think this case with Compton leads to anything consequential?
I can't answer that because over and over we've had outrageous conduct by the Sheriff's Department in the past 2 years, any one of which should have been enough to trigger change. We've triggered an investigation by the state regarding civil rights abuses. We've got litigation happening now with the county, multiple litigations. I can't tell you which incident will be the one that ultimately results in real change at the Sheriff's Department, but I sure hope it's soon.
All right. I know this conversation has only scratched the surface. Again, that is Max Huntsman, Inspector General for Los Angeles County. Mr. Huntsman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, we reached out to the LA County Sheriff's Department for a response to Compton's allegations. We're still waiting to hear back. Next up, another local Olympian joins us, weightlifter Sarah Robles. That's all on Greater LA.
This is Greater LA on KCRW, and I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. After getting postponed last year due to the pandemic, the 2020 Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo are supposed to begin on July 23rd. Now, I say supposed to because some fear the Tokyo Games might be postponed again or canceled altogether because of a spike in COVID cases in Japan and other countries participating in the Games like India. But that's not stopping the world's Olympians from continuing to train and prepare for the Games. They include Southern California's own Sarah Robles. Robles is a 2016 Olympic bronze medalist and was just nominated to her third U.S. Olympic team in the sport of weightlifting for the Tokyo Games. And she joins me now. Hey, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So a little bit about your background. You grew up in the Coachella Valley, and I understand you were initially attracted to track and field and then got interested in weightlifting. How did you make that shift?
Well, initially I did weightlifting as strength and conditioning for track and field. And I thought, oh, I'll just, you know, do this when I retire from track and field, you know, because I had aspirations of having a Division I scholarship and possibly competing at the Olympics for track. That's kind of where my line of thinking was going. But my sophomore year in college, while I was redshirted at Arizona State University, I needed a place to train, so I picked up weightlifting again, competed at a local meet, qualified for a national meet. Then I qualified for an international meet. And when things didn't go exactly as planned with my track career, I decided to give weightlifting full-time a try for a year. And it ended up turning out to be a success. And a few short years later, I was already on my first Olympic team.
What do you love about it? Whether it's in competition or training, what is it that just excites you about the sport?
Definitely competition. Training, the day-to-day grind is not a fun experience for me. But actually traveling and meeting interesting people and hopefully having the opportunity to kick everybody's butt, that's what's fun for me. I love seeing my training all come together.
So you don't love the training, but you love the kicking a butt.
I like winning. Who doesn't like winning?
Who does not like winning? Said like a true Olympian. As I understand it, weightlifting has been part of the Olympics since like the first modern Olympic Games in 1896. But women are relatively new to the sport, at least in Olympic competition, right? It started in 2000. You won in 2016 a bronze medal. What was that like? And what do you make of the sport and women in it right now?
Well, let's see. It is a relatively young sport for women on the Olympic stage. But, you know, just like with everything else, you know, historically, like if you actually give us a chance, we'll show you how just how good we are. And consistently for this past 4 years or more, the women have consistently outplaced and outperformed the men. And it's not any diss on the men, but it just goes to show how strong our women's team is right now and how well we're doing internationally. Like, I'm very proud to be a part of this team in this transition in history for women's weightlifting. It's just such an exciting time.
Well, let's turn to the upcoming Tokyo Games. How did last year's cancellation affect you?
Oh, it was a bit of a challenge, you know, to have that postponed a year. And part of that postponement was not even knowing if it was actually going to happen or not. You know, you'd get excited, a competition was coming, then it would be postponed. So it was really hard to stay on track and figure out what exactly to do with your training in order to be able to perform well.
And is it frustrating that at least some of that uncertainty continues where, I don't know, are you completely sure you're going to be in Tokyo in July or are you not? And how does that affect you in the here and now?
I mean, you're in control of your own thoughts. And so I'm controlling my thoughts and just proceeding with everything I have like the games are going to be happening.
Yeah, I know, you know, I don't want to talk to you about your personal finances over the airwaves, but might it have like a real world effect on your pocketbook?
I'm not sure. I mean, we haven't competed at the Olympics and I've been okay, but I mean, who's to say? I mean, the funding is based on your Olympic potential and, you know, that's essentially what it's there for, to support you, to get you to the Olympics. And then if there's no Olympics, then what happens?
Yeah. And just finally, returning to you from the issue of the games, I understand you want to play a role in promoting, you know, positivity for girls and teens in terms of how they look, in terms of their physique. Do you think our culture has made progress when it comes to celebrating all kinds of bodies, all kinds of ways to look?
I think we've made a lot of progress, but at the same time, I feel like progress is still pretty conditional. Like you see in my realm, right? It's thick is in, you know, THICC, right? Like, thick thighs save lives. So like, oh, that's cool. But it's cool if you're shaped like this, you know? So it's like, it's cool that you're bigger, but as long as you adhere to this particular shape or wear these particular clothes. So it's kind of funny how it's gotten better, but then some of the cultural aspects are the same. But what I do appreciate, especially about social media, is the variety of access and the ease of access to people of different body types. So not just my realm of like being a larger woman, but people with disabilities, people of different races and religions, things that you normally wouldn't have seen or be exposed to, you have much easier access to now. And I think that's going to contribute a lot to the future of body positivity, inclusivity, just religious tolerance and all kinds of things. I think it's going to continue to progress, but we have to continue to use our voices and be creative with the tools that we have in order to make it go that direction. And people just have to have an open mind too.
Absolutely. Sarah Robles is a weightlifter from Desert Hot Springs. She was just nominated to her third U.S. Olympic team for the upcoming Olympic Games in Tokyo. Sarah, thanks so much. Good luck, and I hope to see you on the podium.
Thank you. I hope so, too. I hope to see you from there.
That's all we have time for today. Tomorrow, the show is all about LA's Boyle Heights neighborhood. We'll dig into its past, present, and future of this real American melting pot. Of course, you can check out any of our stories online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Taw, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordal all helped put this show together. I'm Saul Gonzalez. Have a great evening.